Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today Fritz Gilbert is joining us today, and Kristen Knapp is hanging out as well. So how are you both doing, Fritz?
Crushing it, man. Just having fun. Economy is a great conference. Just got done with my presentation. Life is good. Pressure's off. I'm, you know, loving life, man. It's good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for popping in here. And we're in the lobby of the hotel. So
the Fairfield.
If the audio is a little different, that's why. Mm. So we're doing our best. There's music in here. There's probably going to be a crowd of people. But yeah, Kristen, how are you?
Oh, I love coming here. It's so fun. I think Diana even joked once that this is kind of a reunion of all the Camp Five people.
It almost is, yeah.
So I have all these people I know from all over the country that I see at different things, but I know that I'll see almost everybody here. And it's just a great opportunity to see your people and give them a hug and reconnect. And it brings me a lot of joy. It fills my cup.
Yeah. How many have you been to?
This is my fourth.
Okay, fourth. And how about you?
Number two.
Two. And I've been to five.
Oh.
Wow.
Super fun. And I keep coming back again and again. And someone else commented, like, there's a lot of returning folks.
This is where we met.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Right over there.
That's right. I was talking trash about meteorology.
Yes, he was.
You called me out on it.
Busted.
It was fair. All right. And today, what are we talking about?
I love Fritz's blog, Retirement Manifesto. A lot of interesting information there. And as someone who is nearing retirement, I'm starting to think through all of these things. And I'll just say it. I'm confused about drawdown strategies. And I'm apparently confusing that a little bit with asset allocation. So I just kind of wanted to talk through all of this because every year there's more people in our community retiring, right? So I think this isn't a topic that gets enough discussion. I feel like there's so much focus on the accumulation. And I want to have a topic about what comes next.
Great topic. Important topic.
And I have an intro, and I'm going to read this the best I can. It's hard for me to read sometimes. Fritz Gilbert is the founder of the award-winning blog, The Retirement Manifesto, which is pretty cool. You actually won an award.
I did. Plutus Award. It's like the Academy Awards of blogging. Yeah, that's cool. And best retirement blog is what it was for. So that's cool.
Very awesome. And you wrote a book, Keys to a Successful Retirement. I told you I can't read very well. Keys to a Successful Retirement, bringing over three decades of corporate experience to the world of financial independence. What'd you do with your day job back in the day?
I was a corporate guy, Fortune 500, variety of jobs, started in sales, moved into plant management, ended up in global management my last 10 years. So kind of went up the chain.
And you retired at 55, is that right?
Correct.
Then you've dedicated your second act into helping others navigate the transition to and through retirement with a focus on practical drawdown strategies and intentional living. So beyond the numbers, you're a passionate advocate for purpose-driven living, spending much of your time building fences for dogs through your wife's charity. Is that a...
We are indeed.
Very
Never
cool.
would have dreamed that was going to be part of our retirement, but it's like a big part of our purpose now, yeah.
And the purpose, just want to say this because this is very important, this is an area where a lot of dogs are on chains and they have no freedom.
Yeah.
So building a fence for them gives them the freedom to run around their yard, which is so magical, and I love that you do that.
Thank you.
Super cool. And before we get into the nuts and bolts and the nerdy stuff today, I follow you on Facebook, so I see you're walking with your dog. What's your dog's name? Tell us about your dog.
We're dog people.
So right? Three dogs?
We have three now. We had four when we retired, and we traveled cross-country in the RV with four dogs all the way to Seattle. And I mean, we've always been dog people, so we've always done rescues. They're all mixed breed rescues, but the big guy, he's a pit mix and just a bundle of energy. He's 2 years old. He's strong as a horse. And I've got the time. I'm retired. We live in the mountains, so there's all kinds of hiking trails. It's beautiful. So one of my things that I do now, I'm focused on fitness and longevity and all that. So as part of my mix, I try to do I call them a fitness hike. Like, it's high intensity, a lot of elevation. Usually try to get at least 1,000 feet, 8 miles, once a week. And I do that with a big guy, Toby is his name.
Awesome. So,
cool dog.
And you're... So I am from the Atlanta area, so I did go up to your
Blue Ridge,
right around there. So you're hiking like AT stuff and adjacent around Springer Mountain and such.
Okay. The Appalachian Trail actually starts in our county. So, you know, you got the Appalachian Trail, you've got the Benton Mackay, who was the guy that originally had the idea for the Appalachian Trail, but he wanted to go to a different place.
Right.
So they were like, well, let's do one for him. And it starts on Springer Mountain, same as the AT, but it goes west instead of east. And then they meet up again in the Smokies. So I hike all over there. There's hundreds and hundreds of miles of trail. trails in the North Georgia Mountains. So it's great. I got a lot of choices.
Super cool. Thanks for letting us talk about that for a second. But let's get into the nerdy stuff before all the people get in here.
Okay. So,
Kristen, it's going to go crazy.
So I have all the questions. Okay. So as we're nearing retirement, how important is it to choose a specific strategy versus just kind of taking out money willy-nilly as we need it?
Yeah. I think from a macro perspective, one of the things people have to think about is they're in the last couple of years of the FI journey. Is the skills that they've developed to get to FI are not the skills you need post-FI because you've been accumulating. It's easy. Dollar cost average, you know, VATSX. Did I get that right? VATSX.
Yes, you got it.
See, I'm retired. I don't do that anymore. And the rules are different because your risks are different, right? Sequence of return risk, inflation. When you're working, your risk is, oh, if I lose my job, how much emergency fund should I have? So I think the general premise is recognize that the skills you've developed aren't going to be sufficient for the next phase. And those skills include things like understanding what the drawdown strategy options are and understanding how you're going to structure that and what do you need to do for your asset allocation to recognize the reality that the risks post-FI are different than the risks pre-FI, right? Because the whole purpose of a strategy is to mitigate your risks to the extent possible. So all this discussion around drawdown strategies, how you set up your paycheck, all, you know, Roth conversions, all of that really sits within this bubble of what skill sets do you need to develop to manage your finances post-FI. That's where the drawdown strategy comes in. So with that said, as part of that, you need to gain an understanding of what are my options.
Kind of, yes, what are the, please. That is why you are here,
yeah,
my friend.
Exactly. And what are the pros? Now, you know, you can say, okay, I'll stay 100% VTSAX, and whenever I need money, I'll sell it. Fine. But what are your risks? What did they change? Sequence of return risk. What does that mean? You get a 15 or 20% drop in the market 6 months before you're going to fire. You still going to fire? Probably not. You're going to freak out, and you're going to say, I got to keep working until the market comes back. Oops, you messed up. You should have had a strategy in place. Sequence of return risk doesn't start the day you fire. It starts like a year or two before you, actually about 5 years before you fire. So as you get closer to fire, no matter what strategy you come up with, the basic premise is you've got to change your asset allocation because your risk profile is changing. So no matter how you do it, the basic premise is what do you want to do to reduce your, let's just assume you're very aggressive, 100% VTSAX. When and how do you start making adjustments to that to give yourself a buffer against market volatility, because when you're accumulating, market volatility doesn't really matter. You're buying every day, so it's actually a good thing. You want the market to go down.
Yeah.
Once you retire, that's exactly the opposite.
Well, I know
so
your
you need
way
to have a buffer.
Isn't necessarily the end-all be-all. I know there's different ways of doing it, but I'd be curious to know what you moved to in the years leading up to retirement.
Great question. And I've written a couple posts on this. I wrote one that's kind of the macro drawdown strategy, which gets into stuff like Roth conversions and HSA and Social Security claiming. So that's kind of the macro strategy. And anybody can look it up on my site. Interestingly, I went back 3 years after I fired, and I kind of gave myself a post-mortem and said, okay, how did I do? And I graded on each one of the elements and gave myself a score. So that was kind of fun. So you can look that up. But within that, and we can talk probably, there's too much in there to talk about comprehensively, but I think the thing, when we talked earlier, your real question is how do you develop this paycheck? Mm-hmm. And what's the right process to do that? Which I think is that there's enough content there just to talk about. And the system I've used is kind of the bucket strategy, I call it. I didn't invent it, but it's basically a premise of defining your asset allocation based on how many years of spending do you want protected. You don't even think like that when you're accumulating, right? Years of spending, it's not even a factor. So let's just say you spend $50,000 a year. You, in my case, we said, okay, we're going to put 3 years of cash in bucket one. So that's 150 grand, right? If you're spending 50 grand a year. And then bucket two typically is bonds, but it can be REITs. It can be other less volatile asset classes than stocks. So I typically say REITs and bonds. It's easiest. And that's typically, in my case, again, the beautiful thing about this, you can make those buckets any size you want. But what I settled on was 3 years of cash, bucket one, 8 years of bonds and REITs, bucket two, and then the rest is in equities, bucket three.
The number of years you're talking about, is that kind of the general consensus among most people who do buckets? How many years
No,
they do?
There's a lot of, I mean, if somebody says, no, I don't want to put 3 years of cash, that's too much opportunity cost. Fine, you can do 2 years of cash. You can do 1 year of cash. That's really driven by the individual risk tolerance and what you're comfortable with. You get like Big Earn, he'll say, oh, it doesn't make any difference. You're not really buffering against sequence of return risk. It doesn't make any. So everybody's got a different opinion. Mm-hmm. I think the important thing is to kind of, like what Big Earn will say is, that's just too much work. Just focus on your asset allocation and just sell whatever's doing well to pay, you know, fund your paycheck. You
so can do why that. Do you choose not to do that way?
Well, the funny thing is at the end of the day, when Earn and I, this went on for probably a year and a half, we had a kind of an open debate. It was fun. We were having fun with it. And at the end of the day, he goes, actually, what I'm doing is kind of the bucket strategy, but I just don't think it's right to call it the bucket strategy, because mm-hmm. that's just a psychological mm-hmm. game that you're playing, that you think you have safety, and in right. reality, you don't. So, but he says, really, we're kind of doing the same thing. So he looks at his asset allocation, he looks at whatever's up, and that's what he sells to fund his paycheck. I kind of do the same thing. I've just got this bucket of cash, but I'm pulling out of it every month, right? I've got a paycheck coming. So as that goes down, I've got to decide what asset class am I going to use to refill it. It's the same process.
So the number of years that you have for each bucket, that's the goal then is what? You've looked at how many years the average bear market lasts, or how long potentially the worst bear market could last, and you're making sure that you don't have to sell in a drawdown situation?
In general, the logic. And my feeling is 3 years of cash, most of the bear markets in the last 20 years have been pretty quick, right? So it never even affects you. The thing you want to do is you want to avoid selling equities after they've gone down. Bottom line, that's the goal. How you structure yourself to avoid doing that is really where, you know, you can say, okay, you know what? I'm just going to go with asset allocation. I'm going to hold 20% in gold because gold's countercyclical. And if I have stocks go down, I'll just sell gold. That's fine. You can go about the strategy in different ways, but the concept is, what buffers do you want to have in place to minimize your risk of having to sell bonds, stocks after a downturn? So I use stocks and bonds and REITs. And I say, okay, 3 years of cash, I don't want to do more than that because there is an opportunity cost, right? Yields aren't as big, but I'm not as concerned about that because it's like buying insurance for your house. Nobody doesn't buy insurance for your house, but that's stupid. You're spending all this money for what? Mm-hmm. Well, in case the house burns down. Well, why do I have cash? In case the market goes down. It's the same thing. So I don't care about the cost of that bucket. That bucket is purely liquid, available, no problems. That's worth a little bit of opportunity cost. But you don't want to do too much, right? So beyond that, I'll do 8 years of bonds, with the feeling being bonds typically are countercyclical to stocks. So if stocks are down, theoretically, I could go 11 years and never have to sell stocks. If that happened, you'd be a basket case. But no right. strategy would work. If stocks were down for 11 years straight, it'd be a tough market. So you can't go overboard and look at, you know, okay, depression era, because then you give up the other big risk in the post-fi environment is longevity risk. You're going to live for a long time. You don't want to, you know, have your money run out before you die. So you've got to have an element that's there for long-term growth, to keep up with inflation, to live, be there if you live a long time. So there's a balance between all these risks. So that's why I say, okay, if you think about a 30-year spending bucket, which is what I've got. That's like a 3.3% safe withdrawal rate. We can get into that calculation, but everybody knows a 4% rule. So a 4% rule is what? 25X, right? Mm-hmm. What's 25X? 25 times my annual spending. Okay, so 3.3% safe withdrawal rate is 30X. Same thing. So I've got 30 years of spending in our portfolio. So it's really changing from just looking at asset allocation to thinking about years of spending. So if you've got 30 years of spending in your portfolio and you've got 3 years out of 30 in cash, that's a 10% asset allocation. I've got, what I say, 8 years of bonds out of 30 years. That's a, whatever it is, 30%, about 30% allocation to bonds. So it all comes back to asset allocation. But the way you get there is by thinking in terms of how many years of protection do you want against a potential long-term market downturn.
And you chose 11 because there's some historical data that suggests
I didn't really get
number.
Analytical about it. I just okay. did some reading and kind of what general guidelines. And that's the beauty of this is you can adjust this to any spending budget, and you can adjust those buckets for as long or as short as you want. I mean, you can have 1 or 2 years in cash and 3 years in bonds and say, okay, I'm comfortable with that. I want the rest in VTSAX, you know. That's okay. It's whatever fits your risk profile. And as you do that, you're increasing your risk if there's a longer-term downturn. But theoretically, over time, you'd have a higher return because you got a little bit higher allocation to stocks. But you're doing that with a higher risk because you've got a higher allocation to stocks. So it all kind of fits together, this risk. That's why I started the discussion on thinking about your risks, because it all comes back to the risks. And how you balance that risk and how conservative you want to be balancing that risk ultimately has, you know, some impact on your long-term return. Because if you take everything out of stocks and put it in cash because you're nervous, well, you're probably going to die before you're going to run out of money before you die.
As far as this community goes, would you say you're being conservative? What do most people think? I don't know. I don't know where you fall.
I would say I'm on the conservative end. Big Earn's probably on the more aggressive end. He's like, you don't need all that. Just VTSAX. And so, you know, he's not quite that aggressive, but yeah, there's a range, and I'm probably on the more conservative end. When I was planning for FI, I was always that guy that said, I'm going to assume 8% return instead of 10, and I'm going to assume, you know, inflation running at 4% instead of the historical 2. Mm-hmm. So I kind of sandbagged my numbers a little bit. I built in some discretionary spending because if things got tight, I wanted to have the flexibility to cut spending out. And everybody's like, well, then you're never going to retire. You're going to work the rest of your life. Yeah, but I wanted to have that peace of mind. That tells me I was a little bit more conservative. And I probably worked, you know, a year or two longer than I could have if I would have been more aggressive with the numbers.
That's pretty much what my wife did. She like kind of overestimated some things and underestimated. So I think she ended up working a little bit longer. Now I'm curious, you mentioned you kind of need to start allocating a few years ahead of time, maybe 5 years before you retire. Did you do that?
And
tell us about your specific...
The biggest focus for me was getting... I was pretty heavy in stocks. 3 to 6 month emergency reserve. You know, I didn't have a lot. And I knew I had to build up that cash. So what I chose to do was, in my last couple of years of work, I dropped my 401k contribution. I was saving 25, 30% of my pay. So I dropped the 401k down to the 6% match, and that was it. And I took all the same, I saved the same amount of money, but rather than going into the 401k, I pushed it all into a Capital One 360 money market fund, and I just started building cash. And I just said, okay, I've only got 6 months. I got to get it to 3 years. Let's use 150,000 example we were talking about. If you got to go from, was that 25,000 of cash to 150,000 of cash, that's going to take you a little bit of time, right? Yeah. So I started about 3 years before I retired. Now, I didn't do it by reallocating a lot of my stocks. I could have just said, I'm just going to sell stocks and move it into cash. I was like, you know what? I like my stocks. I'm just going to redirect my investments and try to grow it that way.
Got it.
So you could be more aggressive and say, you know what? Market's good. I'm just going to sell 3 years worth of spending in stocks and move it all to cash. That's okay. You could do it in a shorter time frame, but you're increasing your risk because what if the stock market goes down before you sell that 3 years worth of spending, mm-hmm. right? Then you're kind of caught.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 3 to 5 years is not inappropriate because of the amount of time it takes to build 3 years of cash if you want to do it by new savings.
One observation I have is so many people want to DIY in our community, and they don't want to hire an advisor, even for just a once over. And I think some people miss this, and maybe they hear other people talk like, hey, I want the maximum returns. I could handle it. And maybe they can't handle it, but sometimes if the market drops like 50%, some people are going to get a little nervous and they're not going to react how they think they will. But the point being, I think some people DIY, they miss this and then they can't actually, they didn't understand the risk profile that they were moving into and what they needed to do. Do you have any, is that what you say?
100%. I've been a DIYer since I was 22 years old and started working. Spent decades studying this stuff. And I still didn't know about how different these skills were for, you know, I learned them, but I recognize as a DIYer especially that I'm kind of not sure what skills I need over there on that other side of the line. I know what I'm doing in accumulation. I got that down pat, right? That's easy. But I thought I was, and I was doing research and I was reading, and I was thinking a lot about it, studying it, and I was developing my strategy, but I was like, you know what? Doggone it. I'm just going to go ahead and get a retirement readiness review, one-time check, because the experts in the world, they do this every single day, and they've seen 1,000 people go through it, and they've seen trains go off the tracks, and they've seen people that have crushed it, and they kind of know where the landmines are. I felt like there's a risk that I don't know what I don't know.
Blind spots. You just don't know it.
Blind spots. So I did a retirement readiness review just because I was concerned about the blind spots, and it was money well spent. Well, actually, I didn't spend it. Long story, but I had a retirement readiness review, and I was able to get a free one.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I've talked to some people.
But I'd pay for it.
This usually costs like between, maybe $4,000 to $10,000, depending on who you work with or something.
I thought, like some of the hourly guys, I don't know. I'd be guessing.
It's a few thousand bucks.
A few thousand bucks. Money well spent.
Due diligence.
Let's say you got a $1 million portfolio. Come on. couple thousand bucks to make sure you're doing that right. Absolutely, yeah. Money well spent. Now, I did a case study type approach to answer your question. I volunteered to be a case study, and it worked. That's gotcha. Kind of how I went. Yeah.
All right.
I'm curious about, you know, in this community, so many of us know the 4% rule, right?
Yep.
Which is based on a 60-40 portfolio.
Yep.
And that seems like a pretty simple strategy too. So why does buckets appeal to you over maybe than just doing that?
Well, basically, if you think about, let's talk about each one in turn, the 4% rule. That is kind of a fundamental part of my strategy as well, because the 4% rule simply defines how much you can spend. Let's use the $1 million. You got $1 million, 4% rule, you can spend $40,000 a year. Okay, so my buckets, 3 years at $40,000 apiece would be $120,000. Where did I get that $40,000? The 4% rule, right? So the 4% rule is basically just saying how much can you spend safely from your portfolio. And you could say, hey, the new numbers are 5. I'm going to go with 5. Again, that's personal risk profile. I went with a little bit less because when I retired in 18, there were a lot more people that were kind of saying that was the right number. So you can use whatever you want. So the let's go one step by step. The 4% is basically defining how much you can spend. And then you get into like 60-40 versus the bucket strategy as an example. They are both basically just ways that you want to set up a structure. The important decision to make is what structure do you want to set up when there's not, you know, fire in the streets and everything's calm and you're thinking through this rationally that you're comfortable, you can live with regardless of what happens in the market. And they're both basically the same. I've written some articles comparing the 60-40 versus the bucket strategy. How would they have performed? Since I've retired, I did $1.5 million portfolio, retired in 18. How did they compare if you went to 2025? The bucket strategy outperformed by like $200,000 on $1.5 million. So it was big. Hmm. But then I did the lost decade, 2000, 2010, where there, you know, markets were flat for 10 years, and the 60-40 won by 90,000. I haven't published that yet. So if you guys get this out quick enough, you'll beat my post on that. So I did that because the readers were like, yeah, but what about a bad market? I said, okay, I'll do the lost decade and we'll compare it. So they're both the same basic premise of just a system. But the most important thing is develop a system. So you're not going to do something stupid when stocks fall, because stocks will fall. It's going to happen. Guaranteed. You're going to have probably 2 or 3 bear markets during your retirement.
So what is it about the bucket strategy to you that's so appealing? Is it a lot of the psychological?
It
feels like you can sleep better at night in a bear market,
it's
right?
And I've heard readers tell me that. They said, look, I know they're kind of the same, 64. When I did this comparison, comments exploded. It was really fun. But one guy said, you know, I get it. They're kind of the same. But man, when I'm just sitting there thinking 60-40, it's kind of intangible. When I think I got 3 years of cash sitting there, that just gives me comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And yet his asset allocation is probably 60-40, right? Because it's kind of, it depends how many years of spending you've got in your portfolio. But theoretically, it's about a 60-40. And he just said, I just like, and that's where I'm at. I like that peace of mind of knowing I've got X number of years that I could potentially hold my breath if I had to. And you don't get that with a 60-40, right? So it's just, but then other people say, yeah, but 60-40 is easy. End of the year, you just do the math and boom, you just do it and it's done. Fair enough. You're right. It does. And they both work. And now other people say, well, yeah, but both of those are outdated and those are old. You should do something like Frank's, you know, risk parity. There's a million. And then, oh, you should have dynamic spending. Yeah, you should have dynamic spending. You can build that into any withdrawal strategy you want. So let's finish up on the options. So I'm talking bucket strategy versus 60-40, kind of the same. Different market environments are going to perform differently. Whatever gives you peace of mind, as long as you stick with it through thick and thin, no problem. You can do things like the risk parity, which is, to my understanding, I'm not an expert, but it's basically an asset allocation model where you get really uncorrelated assets, 25% precious metals and whatever. So you've always got something that should be up that you can sell from. Not a bad strategy, right? It works. And Frankl swore till he dies, right? He's passionate about it. So there are people that are absolutely gung-ho for that. You can be somebody that says, you know what? I'm not going to worry about any of that. I'm just going to sell whatever's up and I'm not going to worry about it. That's not a great strategy, but theoretically, you'd probably be okay, you know, if you've got some asset allocation, diversification. I think diversification, no matter what you do, diversification has to be a piece of it. Mm. If you've been 100% VTSAX, you need to get some diversification. International, some bonds, maybe some REITs, maybe some cash, right? You need to have some roughly uncorrelated asset classes so that pretty much in most predictable or not predictable, historically predictable cycles, you'd have something that you could sell to fund your paycheck. That's really what it comes down to.
Did we hit all the different main types of strategies?
I mean, to be honest,
there's so many, right?
Well, and I've been retired 8 years now, and I chose what I chose, and yeah. I'm good with it. And I just kind of, I mean, I write a lot, but I still don't. It's like, okay, I wouldn't be talking about, you know, I've been retired 8 years now, fired. That's a long time. But so I don't sit there and think about, you know, I'm going to buy your savings rate. I don't think about savings rate. It's irrelevant to me anymore, right? So I don't keep up on kind of what's going on with savings rate theories and all that because it doesn't matter to me anymore. So once I kind of got settled on what strategy worked for me, I kind of said, okay, that's good. I've got a, you know, investor policy statement. I've got a drawdown strategy written, and that's kind of what I chose, and that's kind of what I'm going with. So I haven't really stayed up on it. It's a constantly evolving field. And I'm sure you could go ChatGPT and say, what are all the various retirement drawdown strategies? And you'd probably get 10 or 15 that you could start researching right away.
Is this a good place for me to start asking you all the details of how you implement your plan then?
Sure.
Okay. Because I want to know, I want to start talking about this paycheck.
Yep.
Do you pull money from your cash monthly, annually? How do you do that?
So what I do is I set up backup. Every strategy you pick has to have logic, right? So my logic as I was putting this together was all through my working career, we never had a budget. We saved off the top and we knew we could spend what was left. I don't want to get into retirement and feel like I have to budget everything. I don't want to do that in my retirement years. That's crazy. So I want to set up a system where if I got money in my checking account, I can spend it, just like it's been for 30 years of work. So that was my goal. So what I did is I said, okay, I got 3 years of cash. We talked about that. I'm going to keep at least a year of it in a Capital One money market fund. And every month I'm going to do an automatic ACH into my checking account. So I literally get a paycheck once a month that comes from Capital One to checking. And that's what's nice about that is I can look at it as if I keep it clean, I can look at my Capital One account on January 1st and look at it on December 31st. I know how much I spent. No budgeting, no tracking. Done.
But you're generally sending yourself 1/12 of the annual
Correct.
Amount, which is the 3.3%
exactly.
or whatever.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep. So if you use the 50,000 example, that'd be, can't do math on air, $4,000 a month, right? So you do $4,000 a month, just transfers, and you know I can just spend what's in my checking account. And typically, you should have in your spending assumptions, again, how conservative you want to be. You're going to have some luxury stuff in there, right? You're going to be traveling. Okay, I'm going to do $1,000 a year because I want to go to Europe, whatever. So theoretically, in a normal environment where you're not doing those big trips that you've kind of built in your budget, that checking account over the course of the year should be growing a little bit because you've got some extra stuff built into your budget to be safe. So what happens is as you go through the year, you'll start seeing that creep up a little bit and say, you know what? It's not like when you're in the accumulation phase. I should save that. No, you shouldn't. You can safely spend it. If it's in your checking account, you can and you should spend it. And it's really good because after a life of FI, you're naturally frugal. That's a habit you've developed. And having that balance grow in your checking account and not allowing you to put it back into savings kind of forces you. So if we have money left at the end of the year, we give it to charity. It's like spend it or give it away because you don't have to, you can't save that. That's a penalty if you save it. Bad on you, right?
Yeah. I love
you're
that.
You're within your safe. So it helps you force yourself into learning
yeah.
how to spend.
I've heard people say things like, yeah, at the end of the year, if there's like money left, you have to donate it to the opposition political party. So you better spend it,
That's
right?
That's funny. I'm going to help you get a car. I don't care what kind of car.
Well, so what happens when, I would assume, and I've heard about this before, in a typical year, if everything's kind of working like it's supposed to, we don't have any crazy bear markets or whatever, you would probably just rebalance every year, right? And then that forces you to sell high, buy low, just automatically puts everything back in the right percentage.
Let me walk through that. So basically, theoretically, yes, you're correct. I do a deep dive, net worth update, asset allocation, all that deep dive every January 1st, right?
Okay.
First week of January, that's what I'm doing. It's the only time of year I do it. I don't look at it beyond that. It doesn't matter. But think about this. My goal is to have 3 years of cash.
Right.
Starting in January, I go to December. I haven't refilled a dime. How much cash have I got? 2 years.
Right.
So what happens if there's a bear market on December 30th? I just lost a year of my protection, right? So I will, through the course of the year, probably once a quarter, I can look at my Capital One. Here's how much I spent because it's going out automatically. And I can look at beginning balance and say, okay, I got to restock. I'm down 20,000. Should I, you know what? Markets are still holding on pretty good. Yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and sell some stocks and put it back into cash.
So you don't, okay. So,
so
you
I will kind of do,
add.
I'll kind of look at it quarterly. But it's kind of a quick, I look at just my asset allocation, what asset class is up the most from my January 1 number. Instant, you can tell, whatever segment's up the most, okay, I can sell some of that. And I'll just do a quick, I mean, it's a 10-minute exercise. So I might do occasional refills through the year. That was a change I made early on, because the first year I retired, the markets went down. I was like, ooh, I should have. So I like that for me, because it kind of keeps that 3-year buffer intact. But I'm not religious about once a quarter.
You could do it once a year.
You could do it once a quarter. Okay. You could do it once a month.
Once a year.
I had one guy ask me, should I do it like every month? I was like, you know. He said, I'm thinking about rebalancing every month. I was like, yeah, that's overkill. That's trying to optimize and you're ruining your life, right? You don't want to be doing that.
If I wanted to do it once a year, what would you say to me?
Absolutely fine.
Okay.
No problem.
So what happens if we have a 2-year bear market?
Then you got 2 years. You might have to dip into your bonds because you didn't have quite as much cash as you had hoped you were going to have. You'd be fine, right? Or you can say, you know what? I don't want to have any less than 3, but I only want to do it once a year, so I'm going to start the year at 4. I mean, right? All this is customizable. So you can, maybe you split the difference. Say, I'm going to go to 3.5, and then the worst I'm going to be is 2.5 by the time I do it at the end of the year. You can adjust any of the stuff that you want. So that's number one. And then at the end of the year is when I do my deep dive. And that's when I look at how much my spending actually was. I incorporate, this is another element we should talk about, the dynamic spending concept.
Please share.
Yes. So the 4% rule, which people would argue now is like 5%, right? Even Bill Bengen came out and said, well, you know, with the asset classes we have now, 4 is actually closer to 5. Doesn't matter. Splitting hairs, although it's a big difference. But
yeah.
But regardless, no matter which of those you believe, the data is clear. If you can, in addition to that, incorporate kind of these guardrails, dynamic spending around that, you greatly increase your chances. So what I do, this is once a year, to your point, year-end deep dive analysis, I update our net worth, I strip out all the non-spendable assets, the house, the cars, so I end up with a liquidity pool, I call it my retirement reserves, and I'll multiply that by 3, 3.5, 4, 4.5%, right, to get a range of, okay, I can make my paycheck anywhere in that range, so it naturally will fluctuate as the market goes up or down, so it's dynamic. But the way I can offset it, because I started with a conservative safe withdrawal rate, so let's say I'm at 3.5. Well, if the market goes down a bunch, I'm okay with going up to 4, 4.5%. So I can absorb some of the downside in the market because I've kind of seen this range of spending, so I can, rather than have to just suddenly eat canned corn every night, I can up my withdrawal rate a little bit and still buy chicken. Right. So it gives you flexibility without getting yourself in too much trouble in terms of overspending after the market's gone down. So I incorporate the dynamic spending and I do that every year end. So then I say, okay, here's how much my paycheck can be. Here's how much I spent. And then I look at the rebalancing, which is basically how many years of bonds do I have? However they performed. You know what? I don't want more than 8 years of bond because I'm conservative, but I don't want too much opportunity cost. So if I've got 9 years of bonds, I'll just take a year's worth of bonds, roll that into cash, and I'm done. I'm back to 8 years of bonds, 3 years of cash, and I never touch stocks. If bonds haven't done too well, but stocks have done great, you know what? I'll just take some out of stocks and I'll pull it back in. And maybe my bonds went down. Oh, I can take some of the stocks and put it into bonds, right? You can, but all that is basically looking at 3 years, 8 years, and then everything else. And you just use that to define what kind of money you need to move around. It takes me like an hour. It's not a big deal.
So if there was like 5 or 6, we had a horrible bear market, it's like 5 or 6 years, you'd blow through all your cash and then you'd get into your bonds. And then it has that happened to you yet in this?
No, 2020, somebody's going to call us out on this, 2018 or was it 2020? I think it was 2018, the year I retired, stocks and bonds went down, which was really unusual. Was that 18?
I remember that. Yeah, I think so.
Which was really unusual. So I was like, oh crap, my strategy. It was a 1-year deal. It was no big deal. And it bounced right back. The other thing, I keep it simple, stocks, bonds, equity, or cash for the example. But the reality is I've got like 10% alternatives. I've got some gold. I've got some stuff. I do stupid option trading. I've got a kind of a fun market. Fun. It's a Charles Schwab, maybe 5% of my net worth, but it's where I do stupid trades, right? So there's always stuff in there. So I've got other things that I could sell. And actually in 18, when bonds and stocks both went down, I went into that alternative class and I had some stuff in there that was up. So I just used that. So I'm looking at the whole portfolio and again, diversification, right? You want things that are not on the same cycle. And the more of those you have, the more options you get into. So even if you had a eight year down market, I'm pretty convinced you're going to have something that's not down as much as everything else. International stocks maybe this year, okay. Right? Maybe domestics go down, but internationals doing fine. Well, it's still stocks. It's in that stock bucket. But international is actually up 20% and domestic ended up down 10. Fine, I'll take international. So I even look at subsets within those asset classes.
Got it. And one clarification. So you mentioned you have dynamic spending, but really, are you adjusting your spending, or it just happens to be you're spending the same, but the percentage is higher because your portfolio is now smaller?
Well, I've been fortunate. Since I retired in 18, the market's been crazy, right? Yeah. So my safe withdrawal rate's probably actually declined because the portfolio has gone up a lot more than I assumed. Theoretically, I would increase my safe withdrawal rate to a limit, but I probably wouldn't go over, I'd probably go to 5% for a year. Mm-hmm. And say, okay, is market going to come back? If I had to cut my spending by 20% because my whole portfolio was down 20%, I'd say, okay, I'm going to bump up my safe withdrawal rate to the maximum level I think I can survive to buffer some of that. But I wouldn't go to 7 or 8% safe withdrawal rate. I don't want to cut my spending. I want to cut my spending if the portfolio is down that much.
Right. And then the other thing is, you've been retired 8 years. Your portfolio is probably bigger than you thought it was going to be was in the beginning. So you're at 3.3, but really you started at 4, right?
I started at 3.3.
Oh, you did? Yeah, and holding steady.
So yeah, I mean, basically I looked at my range. Okay, but then my checking account gets bigger and I end up giving more to charity.
You're spending more.
We're giving more away. We're giving more to charity. It's so basically where it's going.
If you started at 3.3, you're still at 3.3.
But it's going to charity.
Okay.
So I'm spending,
And your portfolio is way bigger. Have you thought about maybe I'm going to increase that 3.3 to, have you toyed with that idea?
Yeah, it's funny. Doug Nordum, Doug Hawaii, what's his name? Nortz. Everybody knows about Nortz.
Yeah.
Nortz.
That guy.
I remember Nortz. I was talking to him at the FI thing because he retired earlier than all of us, right? He's like the OG of this world. And I love the guy. Surfs all day in Hawaii. He's a great guy. And I remember talking to him. And he goes, he said, I was conservative, 4% rule, blah, blah, blah. He said, my portfolio has just grown and grown and grown because the 4% rule is designed for the worst case market environment. And that doesn't normally happen. It certainly hasn't happened in the last 20 years. So your portfolio is going to be better than that 4% assumption.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm down to 2%, 2.5%. He goes, I can't spend any more money. He said, I got everything I need. I don't need funds. Okay, I got a 2% safe withdrawal rate. So what? My portfolio's done well. So to answer your question, when I did this comparison, I did a comparison between the bucket strategy and 60/40. And it was interesting. So we can use those numbers because they're not mine. I just use a hypothetical. $1.5 million, 2018, January 1st. 60/40 approach versus bucket strategy approach. Actual market returns, actual inflation, spending increased by inflation, blah, blah, blah. Annual rebalancing according to the strategy's guidelines. $1.5 million. It ended up being in the bucket strategy by 2025, 7 years later. I think it was $2.4 million, $2.3 million. And the 60/40 was a little bit less than that, 2.1, something, 2.2. So yeah, you're up by, 60%, or whatever it is, do the math. Yeah. It's over $2 million if you start $1.5 million. So, and that's with spending every year. So yeah, and that those aren't my numbers. That's just math. So it depends on your asset allocation, blah blah blah, rebalancing. But anybody that retired in the last 10 years, I guarantee you, they've got more money than they thought they'd have. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned as I've continued to study this and talk to people that are experts in this area, most of the people in this community, right, when they're nervous about it. They're obsessive about these spreadsheets. They're going to have the same thing. And if you have any friends that are financial advisors, ask them this question. Say, hey, how many 80-year-old clients do you have? Oh, I got a couple of them. Yeah, there's Bob and Joe, these guys just died. So they got more money than they ever thought they'd have? Oh, yeah, 100% across the board. If they're responsible, if they would have been part of this community 30 years ago, they are absolutely swimming in money and their kids are going to be millionaires on the day they die. Absolutely across the board, because everybody plans to the most conservative assumptions, and typically that's not what happens. They're the most conservative assumptions for a reason, because if that happens, you want to make sure you survive. But in anything better than that, your portfolio will grow through retirement. It's counterintuitive, but it happens.
So should we always be spending more then, Fritz?
Well, that's kind of where the 5% came from, right? It all comes down to risk.
Yeah.
Sure, you can spend more.
Yeah.
But how comfortable are you that you might get tight in the end? Do you want to have, are you going to self-insure on long-term care? You better make sure you got something set aside for that, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to end up being on Medicaid and in a Medicaid facility because your money ran out.
Are you trying to leave some generational wealth, or are you kind of more like die with zero kind of guy?
I'm a little bit of both. It's not an objective, But by definition, because we're conservative and I've got some carved out for long-term care, if we don't need long-term care, by definition, she's going to get an inheritance. We joke with her and say, hey, you know, we retired young so that we can spend all your money. So we've told her there's nothing coming because we want her to feel like she has to earn it, right?
Sure.
But realistically, all of our kids are going to get inheritances, right? Anybody that's listening to this, anybody that's in the FIRE community, if you got kids, they're going to get an inheritance.
Yeah.
Because we're conservative. We know what we're doing. We're managing as well. And unless there's a really ugly couple decades ahead that none of us know about, we're going to be just fine.
One thing that, so we have an advisor and we've been conservative. So everything's going to work out. One thing we do need to get more cash on hand. So we had a decent chunk, but we've been trying to manage like how much we're selling. And with the ACA situation, it does make it a little more complicated. Yep. And once you have a decent sized portfolio, the dividends you're pulling in are more than you might think. So it's tens of thousands of dollars. So you only have like a little wiggle room.
Yep.
And the ACA subsidy stuff ends up being like thousands of dollars, like
$5,000-$8,000 It matters.
And it's a return on that right now versus potentially saving on taxes in the future, blah, blah, blah. So there's... There's a lot
I haven't hit that part of my life yet.
You will. How do we start this? The skills you need post-FI are different than the skills you need pre-FI. That's an example of it. Managing your income to take advantage of ACA and tax brackets and all that kind of stuff, Roth conversions, that's a skill set you need. And managing the ACA, what you're talking about right now, that's one of the new skills you need to develop. You do not want to cross that threshold.
Yeah.
So what do you do if you need cash and all you got is appreciated stocks, right? Well, maybe you pull some out of the Roth. Well, I don't want to do that. That's my last minute money. Yeah, but is it worth blowing up your ACA subsidy? Take some out of the Roth, right? It's managing that complexity that makes it a really different skill set.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a complexity question. All this stuff we're talking about, do you think this is something a DIY investor can manage? Or does it eventually become too complex with all the rebalancing and things that have to happen?
100% DIY, no problem.
Okay.
I'm an example. I never knew any of the skills. I developed them. If you were able to develop the skills for the accumulation and you've been DIY for 30 years, you can develop the skills to be post-FI. But recognize you need to develop the skills. That's number one. Number two, think about, you're getting older, right? So think about cognitive decline. Mm. You shouldn't DIY after you're 75, right? So have a plan in place that, okay, hey, I like DIY. I'm not going to pay those AUM fees or, you know, whatever.
What's your plan?
So my plan is, even if I still enjoy it at 75, I'm moving to an advisor.
Okay.
And I write a love letter to my wife every year.
Aww.
And it kind of has our investor policy statement, has some personal stuff in there. You'd expect that. It's got our net worth. It's got kind of everything. And it's got instructions. Hey, if I get hit by a bus, call this person. And I've got an advisor kind of on retainer. And I've talked with them and said, look, can I put you in this letter? And we got some emails back and forth. So my wife's got the contact information. And
that's a great idea.
And so she just calls them and they take it over. So I've thought through that. And even if I'm DIY, I recognize I'm not going to be DIY forever, and even I'm going to die someday. And my wife's certainly not going to be DIY. This is like she lets me manage the stuff. She pays the bills. It works great. So, yes, you can definitely DIY it. You can learn the skills. Recognize you need to learn the skills. Maybe hire a professional to do the review and help you learn those skills or read up on it, listen to podcasts. You know, you can learn this stuff. ChatGPT is great now, right? But even if you decide to do that, don't forget the longer-term risks of DIY and have a plan for that.
Because of the cognitive decline.
Mainly, okay. Yeah. I actually, Dana writes on my blog, Dana Ansbach, and she just published a post last week about a trust. And she didn't have kids. She was single. And she still set up a trust. And she was like, late 40s? What are you doing, right? That sounds crazy. But she said, hey, if it's in a trust, because she's an advisor. And she said, if it's in a trust and I get cognitive decline, it's easy. They can just take it over. If it's not in a trust, it's a lot harder. And I'm like, wow. So she did a trust in her 40s with no kids as a buffer against cognitive decline. That's a forward-thinking person.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been pushing off our trust. We haven't said
one. I haven't done one yet either, but I'm thinking about it too.
Yeah. It's not too bad. I mean, take a few days and whatever, a few $1,000 or whatever.
Is there a certain place you would send people, like certain resources that you feel would be good places to start diving into developing these skills that you speak about?
That's your
blog?
My blog, yeah. I'll do a blog, the Retirement Manifesto, of course. Thank you. Buy my book.
You get a book.
Buy my book. Yeah. You know, it's not like there's a repository, but there's so much content. It's like, how do you find FIRE content?
Yeah.
Is there a place you tell? Okay.
Maybe, I know. People are like, is there a club? Podcast. Where do I sign up?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I think it's just really.
I think what I would say is just do something, Google search, ChatGPT, whatever. Find my blog would pop up, right? If you did that kind of stuff. Look around, decumulation strategies, right? And, you know, Michael Kitsis will pop up. And, you know, all the, there's a lot of people that write about this stuff. And just check them out, you know. Look on YouTube. You'll see a lot of stuff on YouTube. Rob Berger, he does a lot of the stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So find somebody that you kind of connect with. And, you know, I like the way this guy teaches it. I can understand that. And then just start following him. And do it like 3 to 5 years before your FI. You know, start learning it early enough that you can start making those changes while you still have a little bit of runway before
FI. Buckets appeal to my brain, which I feel like buckets appeal to your brain. That's why you're doing this, right? Like the psychology of it all. And you've written a series about it on your website, right?
Yeah, I did. And that's most people. Christine Benz, she's a proponent of buckets. And her argument, kind of like mine, is it's because it's a psychological benefit. It's not necessarily that it's better. It's because it's understandable and intuitively people kind of get it. That's one of the big reasons I do it. And it sounds like that's why Christine recommends it. Yeah, that's really why I do it. It's more for the psychological benefit than me feeling like, oh no, it's, you know, I'm not one of those that's going to optimize to the fifth decimal. Maybe it doesn't work as well in a lost decade. Okay, that's okay. Over time, it'll work. It's fine. I'm comfortable with it, and I understand it, and it works for me. So that's what you got to find is a strategy that you're comfortable with, that you understand, that can offset the risks. And don't just go to me and say, oh, that's what he uses. No, look at some different options and understand them. You know, spend a little bit of time, watch a couple of videos, and kind of say, oh, I get that. I kind of like that. Yeah, I'm gonna look into that a little bit more. And that's how you find your way, especially if you're going to DIY.
Do you like this idea of the bucket strategy? What are your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense to me. Again, the psychological part is usually the harder part.
Yeah. And what do you do? So you said you don't have enough cash because of the tax thing and ACA, and then we diverted. Where are you going in terms of how you manage your paycheck and drawdown strategy?
Great question.
What's your plan, Doug?
I'm
what's your strategy?
This podcast now.
What's your investor podcast statement? What is the
investor policy?
Investor
statement.
Policy IPS. Statement. Yes, I don't have one of those either.
I
or do you?
Not explicitly, since okay. I can't state it now. I'm trying to think. So it's not exactly a bucket strategy, but so we have some cash. It's about a year and some change. Ideally, we would probably have like 2 to 3. Although, like I said, we haven't been like prioritizing that. And generally, so my wife and I have separate finances, but pool it all together. So we view it all in the portfolio, and it's roughly 70% equities, 30%, and then
other stuff. Yeah. Okay.
So.
That's where I'm at, by the way, 70-30 roughly.
Yeah, and like we rebalanced like when she retired and got more bonds in the mix. So I will sell some of my equities to pull some cash flow. My wife has most of the cash reserves, so I'll actually need to sell a little bit, and I will use that for expenses and then rebalance a little bit as we're tweaking things.
Yeah,
do that about monthly or quarterly, like. I don't, kind of like you, I don't want to be in there all the time, but I also want to make sure I kind of space it through the year. So I don't think it's technically a bucket strategy, even though we have a bucket of cash. Me describing that, how do you classify that?
I would say you're aligned with Big Earn. That's pretty much how he does it. He said, you don't have to do all this bucket stuff. Just kind of look at your portfolio and figure out what you can sell to generate cash.
Okay.
So in essence, what am I doing? I'm looking at my portfolio. I'm deciding what I can sell to raise cash. That's why he said, you know, ultimately, we're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's just a little bit different way of thinking about it.
Yep. And like we have the bonds there too, which if you looked at the calculations, is probably like our portfolios probably look the same.
Yeah. Something else you should think about, it's worth mentioning as you get into the tactics of how to do this. When you talk specifically about the bond portion, one of the things that I did after I retired, and I wrote an article about it, but incorporating bond ladders into this really works well. And what bond ladders are. So you got 3 years of cash. Let's use that example, 8 years of bonds. Rather than just have a ETF on bonds, which I learned this after 18. In 18, when the bonds went down, that portfolio went down. An alternative to that is to set up a bond ladder. And in a bond ladder, you can buy, let's say you got 3 years of cash, we're in 2026. So that gets you through 2029, theoretically. You can buy a 2030 bond fund. Invesco has them, BlackRock, look it up. And iShares, and you can get TIPS, you can get corporates, you can get munis, you can get a variety of different type of bonds that mature in December of 31 or 32 or 33 or 34. So what I've done, started in 1920, is I started structuring part of my bucket too in this bond ladder, which has been maturing now, right? It's coming down. I had my first rung, you know, mature last year. So that's cool. So what now I'm doing, because I know for the next 8 years, I've got bonds coming in every single year.
You're not buying individual bonds, though. You're buying the funds with the different dates.
Bonds, no. Well, within a fund for 2031, they own 1,000 bonds. So your risk of somebody going bankrupt and you losing it all, very small, because it's a diversified portfolio of bonds.
But it's a fund. But it's not an individual.
And they all expire by December of 31. Okay. So it turns to cash. So on, and I had my first one. I was like, okay, it'll be interesting. It showed up my cash. The fund liquidated, and it moved into my cash account, in my brokerage account. I was like, wow, it just went into cash. I didn't have to do anything. It's like, this is cool. So it's perfect for the bucket strategy because it just automatically fills half of my spending bucket every December.
Have you written an article about this
strategy? I have. About how to build a bond ladder.
Okay, this is very interesting.
And what happens then is that as those rungs get closer to you, now I know I've got 50% of my cash needs coming up in December automatically. So guess what? I'm carrying less cash.
Yeah.
Because I've got the next 3 years, 50% covered, so I'm down to 1.5 years of cash and 1.5 years of my bond ladders in the next 3 years. It'll be maturing. It's something to think about. Bond ladders are, again, tactics. You can go deep on this stuff. But think of the bond exposure, not just as bond ETFs, but consider constructing bond ladders. You can look up the article on my site or just Google bond ladders and I'll explain how they work. There's actually tools on the Invesco site where it will help you build a bond ladder. Say, I want to build a 10-year bond ladder starting in 2030, going to 2040, and I want to do $20,000 a year. And it'll just go, poof, and it tells you what you need to do, and you click, 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 and you got a 10-year bond ladder. Now you got to have the cash to fund it, obviously. Sure. You know, you got to buy those funds. But what I did is I started to move some of the money from the bond ETFs and bond mutual funds, and I would sell that and buy these specific runs of the bond ladder. So my asset allocation didn't change, but my risk got reduced because now in 2030, I don't have to sell that bond mutual fund, which may be declining in value, right? That yield is guaranteed the day I buy it. I can tell you right now, I'm going to earn 4.7% on that bond. And it's going to be there in December of 2030. It's guaranteed unless there's a huge bankruptcy or something. But again, it's diversified. So all that to say, it's much less risky than owning a bond fund.
Gotcha.
Because that can go up and down. Whereas if you hold bonds to maturity, you get the principal back.
So your entire portion of your portfolio that's bonds in is in a ladder?
Not all of it, because I'm only doing 50% of the spending.
Okay.
So it's, and the bond ladder, remember, is based on 100% spending.
Okay.
For 8 years. So it's not all of it, but it's a portion of it.
Okay. And then what's the other portion in?
I still have it in ETFs and bond funds.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Last question for me, and then we're probably going to wrap. So if you have any others.
No, I'm good.
Okay. So do you have a continuing, like, rolling bond ladder, or you just did the 10-year?
I've been keeping it rolling because the stock markets have been doing so well. So I'm like, you know, markets are up. I'm just going to go ahead and add. As those rungs mature, I will sell stocks and buy the next rung out. So I'm buying rungs like 10 years out, right? Because I've got 10 years covered. So as that bond becomes cash, I'll buy another rung on the far end of it, but I'm selling stocks to do it.
Got it.
So I'm essentially rebalancing, right? I've turned to cash, and now I'm saying, okay, rather than just that coming from now, what I can do when the market's down, I don't add a rung. And I can just chew up that bond ladder for a couple of years and not sell stocks.
Yep.
And that's so that it still fits within that strategy. But right now, because the markets have been good, I'm kind of continually adding. As a year matures, I add a year on the backside.
From which account are you doing that?
I do the bond funds in a pre-tax. Tax location is a big thing. Again, skill sets. What skill sets do you need?
Must be your IRA, right?
Yeah, tax location matters. And people are like, what are you talking about, right? If you're pre-fi, you know, tax location, I mean, you might have heard the concept, but you want your bonds in your pre-tax. Absolutely, because that income counts as the bond revenue counts as income anyway. It's not a capital gains like stocks are. So you want it in the pre-tax because when you pull that out, it's going to be taxed as ordinary income anyway. So there's no tax penalty for bonds in a pre-tax. So that's where you put your bonds. So I put them in there. And what I've started doing, part of my drawdown strategy, was I said, okay, I'm not going to touch my pre-tax. I'm going to do Roth conversions. But once I get into my early 60s, I'm going to be comfortable pulling some money out of pre-tax if I need to, because you're going to get it with RMDs at some point anyway, and it's money. It's there. So I keep the bond portion in there. And when I turn it to cash, I'll just do an IRA withdrawal for that 50% of next year's spending and pay the tax on it. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Where they should be.
Cool.
I just want to say thank you so much for letting me pepper you with all these questions. These are things that I've really been thinking a lot about lately. And I'm like, oh, we're going to see Fritz, Doug. Let's talk to Fritz. Reach out to Fritz. Let's
and you're still confused. You're still confused.
No, I'm feeling. Do I look confused? No. I'm feeling better.
There's a lot here to talk about it in 45 minutes. And that's why again, the premise or the overarching thing is the skill sets are different. And you're right to start asking these questions because you kind of exposed how different they are. And that's, you need some time to process that and learn this stuff. So you're asking the right questions. And everybody listening to this, if you're 5 years or more from FI, this is on your horizon, right? Yeah. Start paying attention. Start finding these resources you're going to draw from to learn this stuff. So you're absolutely spot on to be asking the questions.
Tell people where they can find you and about your books.
Fritz Gilbert at the Retirement Manifesto. So Google my name, I'll pop up, or go on Amazon, type in my name, you can find my book.
All right, yeah, we'll link up to it. And I do want to give you a second. So Freedom for Fido, build fences in your local area. How could people help out if they want to learn more on
awesome.
That?
That's awesome. Thank you very much. FreedomForFido.com is our website. Check us out on Facebook, by the way. Every time we call it Freedom Day, when we let the dogs loose off the chains, we put videos up there. We got a lot of followers on Facebook.
Now. I love that so much.
My blog. We get some guy in California that sounds like a pretty sizable check. It's like, that's really cool. He heard about it through my blog, whatever. And he's like, I love what you guys are doing. So check us out on Facebook to kind of see what we're doing, or go to our website if you want to donate. That's awesome. Thanks.
Awesome. Appreciate it. Absolutely. Yeah, we'll link up so people can get to all the stuff. Cool. Your book, website, Freedom for Fido. Thanks, Fritz.
Awesome. Appreciate it, Doug. Thank you much. Thanks, Kristen.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week.